crisis in Puerto Rico could reshape Florida from school classrooms to politics.
Florida's school voucher program is sending more low-income students to college, but a separate study finds public schools are resegregating.
And the state misses its own medical marijuana deadline.
This is the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition, a new program from WLRN Public Media in Miami and WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. How is the devastation in Puerto Rico from Hurricane Maria impacting the Sunshine State? Why are public schools dividing along racial lines again? And what's behind the state's medical marijuana delay?
You can join the conversation statewide today, 305-995-1800. It's next on the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. Gulf Coast is closely monitoring Tropical Storm Nate's approach. The storm, which is blamed for at least 21 deaths in Central America this week, could make landfall this weekend as a Category 1 hurricane. We have more on this from NPR's Debbie Elliott.
Barrier Islands and low-lying coastal communities are evacuating from the Alabama Gulf Coast to Grand Isle, Louisiana. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards says a Category 1 hurricane could bring dangerous winds, flash floods, and a 4 to 6 foot storm surge.
Anybody who's taken this storm lightly is making a serious mistake. And again, I don't want to cause undue panic or alarm, but people need to be prepared for this.
In the Gulf of Mexico, federal regulators say oil and gas companies are evacuating workers from offshore platforms in the path of the storm. About 14% of Gulf oil production is affected. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
Vice President Mike Pence has arrived in the U.S. Virgin Islands. He'll visit Puerto Rico later today. NPR's Laura Magaki reports Pence's visit will focus on efforts to recover from Hurricane Maria.
The vice president first heads to St. Croix today. He'll take an aerial tour to survey the storm's damage. Then he heads to San Juan, where he and the second lady will participate in a prayer service. The visit comes at a time when both places are still rebuilding. Here in Puerto Rico, just 9% of the electrical grid has been restored, and most hospitals are not yet working at full capacity. Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rossello said in a press conference earlier this week that he feels confident the White House will fulfill Puerto Rico's requests for aid. Lauren Migaki, NPR News, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
The economic toll from Hurricane Maria has yet to be realized, but new data confirm Hurricanes Harvey and Irma have left a noticeable mark on hiring in September, though the damage appears relatively isolated. The Labor Department says there was a net loss of 33,000 jobs during the month, reflecting storm-related disruptions in Texas and Florida. We have more on this from NPR's Yuki Noguchi.
The damage to the job market appears to be relatively isolated. The decline in employment came primarily in the food service industries, which lost more than 100,000 jobs during the month. Hiring in nearly every other sector increased, as did wages. The Labor Department said the jobless rate was not substantially affected by the hurricanes. That fell 0.2% to 4.2% in September. Economists had been expecting to see growth of about 80,000 jobs, about half the growth in August. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. stocks have been trading moderately lower today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average off 34 points at 22,741. S&P is down 7 at 2545. NASDAQ off 2 at 6582. This is NPR News. The Department of Defense says the deaths of three soldiers who were part of a joint U.S. and Nigerian train and assist mission were assigned to 3rd Special Forces Group Fort Bragg, North Carolina. They were killed 2 days ago in southwest Niger during a reconnaissance patrol. The incident is under investigation. This year's Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded to the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports the award is a clear message from the Nobel Committee in response to the recent escalation of nuclear threats.
The Nobel Committee said the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons had been awarded the Peace Prize for its work to draw attention to the catastrophic humanitarian consequences of any use of nuclear weapons and for its groundbreaking efforts to achieve a treaty-based prohibition of such weapons. The Nobel Committee said the nuclear risk to the planet had never been so high. It said
some states are modernizing their nuclear arsenals, and there is a real danger that more countries will try to procure nuclear weapons, as exemplified by North Korea.
The organization called for the world's nuclear powers to begin serious negotiations to eliminate nuclear weapons. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Treasury yields rose after the government's monthly jobs report showed wages had increased more than expected last month, which should keep the Federal Reserve on pace to continue raising interest rates. However, the economy overall did lose 33,000 jobs due to disruptions from hurricanes. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Arcus Foundation, dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. Learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
This is the Florida Roundup statewide edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. This is a new statewide program from Florida Public Radio as we discuss the week's top stories with the journalists reporting them and the newsmakers making the news. Join the conversation throughout the state of Florida by calling us up right now at 305-995-1800.
This week, Melissa, Governor Rick Scott declared a state of emergency in Florida for a hurricane that didn't even hit the state. It was because Hurricane Maria and the humanitarian crisis that continues unfolding in Puerto Rico. You know, Scott's emergency order frees up now state dollars to assist local governments with the influx of evacuees expected into Florida, some of whom have already showed up, and it bars price gouging related to the emergency. The governor spoke with reporters on Wednesday in Key West.
We've opened up disaster relief centers at the Orlando Airport, the Miami Airport, the Port of Miami. The other thing on Puerto Rico, I'm working with the governor's office there and the governor to have our agencies, like our Department of Education, help them with their Department of Education, whether it's people coming here or people staying there, where we can be helpful to them.
Ariel Rivera lives in Lehigh Acres near Fort Myers. He went to Fort Lauderdale this week to pick up family members who fled Puerto Rico. He got them the first plane tickets that he could.
My niece, who's here with me, she lost everything. My mother-in-law, she suffered some damage. But it's not just so much that, it's also this, you know, where they're at that town, the help hadn't arrived yet. So they were down to the bitter end of the food.
Rivera says when Maria hit Puerto Rico, it took 5 stressful days for him to make contact with his family. Quincy Walters of WGCU spoke with Rivera, and he joins us now via Skype from Fort Myers. Quincy, thanks for being with us. Can you tell us a little bit more about this family and their struggles?
Right. So this is a family who comes from Coamo, Puerto Rico. It's a town near the south of the island. And it is Ariel Rivera's niece, her son, who's 1.5, his niece is 8 months pregnant. He also brought his mother-in-law and her mom, who has Alzheimer's.
Wow. Gosh, that's so tough. So once they left and they made their way to your area, who are they now staying with?
They're staying with Ariel Rivera, who lives in Lehigh Acres. The
right.
House sustained damage during Hurricane Irma. There's roof damage. They have a big tarp as soon as you walk in to prevent leaking.
Quincy, it's Tom Hudson.
What did they leave behind?
Yeah, what did they leave behind in Puerto Rico?
So Ariel Rivera's niece, who's 8 months pregnant, left behind her mom, her brother, her husband, and a few other relatives. She's hoping that her husband can come next week.
And so why Southwest Florida?
Southwest Florida, because Ariel Rivera, their relative lives here. They have other relatives in Kentucky, but Florida was the closest they could, and he has the space to accommodate them.
Any hopes to return to Puerto Rico?
Right now, they're not really thinking about that because they said that there's really not much to go back to. And his niece, Nicole, who is 8 months pregnant, he says that she really has no choice but to give birth to her child here.
And Melissa, we've heard stories like that here in South Florida. We've heard some out of Central Florida as well, as Puerto Ricans continue to deal with this humanitarian tragedy. And, you know, it's family members coming for what could be an indeterminate amount of time. Quincy, stand by for a second. Schools, you know, Melissa, throughout Florida are dealing with this as well. In South Florida, Broward County schools have taken in 200 hurricane evacuees, mostly from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. In Miami-Dade County, 115 students from Puerto Rico have enrolled. In Orange County in Central Florida, which includes Orlando, 105 students from Puerto Rico and 58 from the Virgin Islands so far have enrolled there. So this is as much a personal and family story in these communities of Puerto Ricans in South Florida, but it is a bigger state of Florida story. Orange County, in fact, is expecting to get a major influx of Puerto Ricans over the next weeks, if not months. And the district spokesman there, Scott Howitt, says they'll need educators, bus drivers, and maintenance workers.
Our hope would be that when evacuees come, that not only are the students coming, but also the adults who can provide and deliver services and jobs in this community, such as teachers, which are critical.
Now, a group of Republican lawmakers wrote a letter to state education officials this week asking them to ease any regulations that would make it difficult for Puerto Ricans to get here and enroll in schools. They also asked for educators from the island to get their teaching certifications quickly. And Governor Scott also told reporters after a visit to San Juan last week that he wants Puerto Rican students to get a break on college tuition here in Florida.
I already asked all of our state college and universities to do in-state tuition for their Puerto Rican students that are here.
So the influx of Puerto Ricans and the impact on public education here on the Florida Roundup statewide edition. You can lend your voice to the conversation, 305-995-1800, statewide in Florida, 305-995-1800. We're joined now by Jessica Bakeman of WLRN and Tia Mitchell from the Florida Times Union, also with us from our sister station WFSU in Tallahassee. Jessica, first of all, how many students could come to Florida schools from Puerto Rico?
That's really the question, Tom. I think that districts really don't know. As you said, you know, we've already seen hundreds enroll in South Florida districts in Orlando, which are sort of the predictable areas where we had expected to see based on, you know, the populations of Puerto Rican people who are here already. So school districts are just trying to prepare. They're not really sure if they're going to see this huge influx that they expect or if it won't necessarily turn out to be that. But, you know, for families with children, if they want their kids to continue school and not continue to have such a difficult disruption in their education, then they need to leave Puerto Rico because it's going to be a while before the schools there are back up and running.
Yeah, it's not as if schools in Puerto Rico are going to be running next week, maybe even not next month. 10% of the island has power now, and here we are more than 2 weeks after the storm.
Right. So, you know, as you said, a lot of families have already started coming here, and some of the things that schools have been doing already to try to get prepared for them. The federal government has told schools to classify these students as homeless, which means they get free breakfast and lunch. And school districts are also trying to coordinate the resources that they're going to need, transportation. Mm-hmm. Some of them will need English language instruction. Some of them will need counseling because, you know, obviously they've been dealing with such a difficult situation at home. And, you know, for students with disabilities, they might need special education. So, you know, that's a financial challenge for school districts to take on. But, you know, Melissa mentioned that there was a letter that lawmakers wrote, and actually Education Commissioner Pam Stewart responded today, and she signed a waiver of some regulations and state laws to help school districts get kids in quickly, you know, like without proof of age or proof of residence or their transcripts, for example.
It's 305-995-1800 to give us a call here on the Florida Roundup. Tia Mitchell, does the governor's state of emergency help families like this, or is it really more about helping Florida municipalities deal with this influx of new residents?
Well, I would say it's both. The municipalities are needed to help these Puerto Ricans that are coming here, mostly with the clothes on their backs. So from the local government standpoint, it's guaranteeing that they'll get reimbursement for the money they spend, knowing that, you know, their resources are already limited. So that gives them some certainty as they provide help and aid to these folks coming in, that they'll get their money back, as well as, again, relaxing those rules at the state and federal level will provide additional flexibility for local governments and school districts for the resources they can provide. But as a result, it does directly help these Puerto Rican families with access to resources that Jessica has mentioned. And again, a lot of them are coming in. They're not Florida residents. They're not going to have the paperwork and things like that. And without this relaxation of the rules, there would be a lot of barriers, bureaucracy, and red tape. So hopefully that'll make these changes will make it easier for people to more quickly get what they need.
Now, Jessica, will school districts really feel an impact from the new arrivals? Will there be that many students in some areas? I know Miami-Dade in particular is really already kind of set up for this, but what are you hearing about that?
Well, certainly that's true. Miami-Dade, Broward, and Orange counties, being bigger school districts, are equipped and possibly more equipped than some smaller districts to absorb floods of students that come in the middle of the year. Miami-Dade has certainly experienced this before. They had students come here from Haiti after the earthquake there. And they've had, you know, undocumented students who were fleeing war and gang violence and other issues in South America. But like I said, you know, school districts just really aren't sure yet how many students they're gonna get.
They're bracing for it. They're bracing for the influx of students and the demand that it's going to put on the systems. 305-995-1800 is the phone number. Melissa, you know this. 305-995-1800 statewide for the Florida Roundup. Suzanne is on line one from Bonita Springs. Suzanne, thanks for calling. Your thoughts on this?
Hi, I don't know if you can hear me, all right. Thanks for taking my call. I was calling because you had mentioned wanting educators from Puerto Rico to get a certification here in Florida quickly, and I was wondering if for them or even other professionals, is there any chance of them using a certification that they might have from Puerto Rico here in Florida, at least temporarily, until they can have time to get a local certification?
Sure, Suzanne, we got it there. Can teachers who are certified in Puerto Rico come here to Florida to work, Jessica?
Yes, the state has a reciprocity agreement with other U.S. states and territories to help with this process if teachers have a certification elsewhere. One of the things that Education Commissioner Pam Stewart did today was waive application fees for Puerto Rican teachers who are applying for initial certification here, and also giving them a little bit more time to come up with some of the documents they would need to get that Florida teaching certificate, which includes their certificate from Puerto Rico or their U.S. state or territory, as well as their official transcripts from their colleges or universities.
Well, tens of thousands of people from Puerto Rico could make Florida their new home after Maria, and that could change the state's political landscape. The consensus is that an elevated population from the island could shift the balance of power in Florida from Republican to Democratic. Let's go back to Tia Mitchell. Tia, is there any chance all of these new arrivals, particularly those that are expected to crowd into the state's swing area, the I-4 corridor of Orlando and Tampa, could that change the makeup of the Republican-controlled Florida legislature?
Well, that's a very complicated answer because right now, particularly in the House, it's overwhelmingly Republican. But we do know that, generally speaking, Puerto Rican Americans vote Democratic more than Republican. So could an influx of Puerto Ricans becoming Florida residents, which again, right now, they can apply for residency to establish themselves as Florida residents and then be able to vote in Florida elections, but that's going to take time for people to decide if they want to do that. And then once, if and when that happens and there's a critical mass, reshaping kind of the look of the Florida legislature is not something that would happen overnight. It would happen over years and decades. And yes, Florida is a swing state, so even just the small shift in the state's demographics, a higher percentage of Puerto Rican voters can have an effect. But it's something that would happen over time. And again, there would be other factors in play. Even if the legislature does shift, particularly in the House, to Democratic controlled in, say, 10 or 20 or 30 years, we would point to the influx of Puerto Ricans as one factor, but it wouldn't be the only factor.
Quincy Walters of WGCU via Skype from Fort Myers. Let me bring you in from a traditional red part of the state. As perhaps Southwest Florida could see an influx of Puerto Rican voters into Collier County, into Lee County, into these areas, is this potential political shift that Tia talks about over the course of several years, is this on the radar of Republican Party officials there?
I have not talked to any Republican officials based on that, but from the education standpoint, the president of Florida Gulf Coast University has sent a letter to universities in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, inviting people to come take classes here. The family that I spoke to, while they don't have any school-age children, Nicole, the one who's 8 months pregnant, is a pre-med student in Puerto Rico, and she, after I guess she gives birth, she would be interested in taking classes here. And her husband plans to come next week and is looking for work. So I think maybe in the next weeks, few weeks or months, this might be something that our Republican lawmakers would probably need to think about.
Jessica, you've covered the State House. What are you picking up on with this potential shift or potential increase in types of voters? You know, Puerto Rico traditionally has not been thought of on the island as Republican and Democrat. It is kind of statehood or commonwealth, a little bit of a different political issue on the island. But as those Puerto Ricans move to Florida, they become absorbed into this red state, blue state here.
Right. Well, you know, I think one thing that people in the legislature or people who are involved in politics statewide are thinking about is redistricting. So there will be another census in 2020, and after which the legislature will go through the redistricting process. And if there is a flood of new Democratic voters, that could mean more heavily Democratic districts, which could then mean more Democrats in the legislature. Tia obviously mentioned, you know, this is a process that takes place over a longer period of time in the House. It is overwhelmingly Republican, but the margins are closer in the Senate. And I think the Senate is already keenly aware of the fact that there is an anti-Trump sentiment among Latino populations because of Annette Tadeo's recent win in the special election. And so if you have Puerto Ricans coming here who are unhappy with the way the Trump administration has handled the disaster recovery effort there, they could be looking to vote for Democrats. I think beyond the legislature...
Oh, go ahead, Jessica.
Oh, I was just going to say, beyond the legislature, you know, this could also make a difference in statewide elections, which Tia mentioned. And of course, in 2018, we have a gubernatorial election coming up. Rick Scott is term limited, and there already are several Democrats and Republicans lined up to try to succeed him. And of course, he, as a Republican, is widely expected to run for U.S. Senate to challenge senior Senator Bill Nelson, who's a Democrat. And if you look at Rick Scott's elections when he was elected governor, both times it was by a razor thin margin. So if you have a lot more Democratic voters here, that could make a difference.
Sure. Yeah, Tia, this is a state where a little bit of a margin one way or the other can make a really big difference.
That's right. I think not that their intentions aren't sincere, but there's a reason why Governor Scott and Senator Rubio have made trips to Puerto Rico recently.
Tio, leave it there for a second. We'll be back after this. You're listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition from Florida Public Radio. More after this.
With their island practically destroyed, the people of Puerto Rico didn't think anything could descend from the sky worse than that hurricane. Then, like the threatening theme from Jaws, they heard, "Hail to the Chief." I'm Peter Sagal. We'll toss around jokes like some people throw paper towels. Plus, Andy Richter tries sitting on our couch on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturdays at 10 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Nate Turner had a meth habit he couldn't kick. A drug court sent him to a treatment program where he thought he'd get help.
You know, I don't see no recovery. They don't hand out no recovery up there.
Because his treatment turned out to be working for free in a chicken plant.
Our labor, our work, our sweat lined their pockets. And we didn't get nothing for it.
On the next Reveal.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio, the massive spike in unmarried births and the consequences.
I am perfectly comfortable saying that living with two married parents is beneficial for kids. And I know a lot of academics, they don't want to say that, right?
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
Birchfield.
This is the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Give us a call with your thoughts. The number to join the show right now, 305-995-1800. Well, a new study out this week finds low-income Florida students who used vouchers to pay for and attend private schools did better in college than students who stayed in traditional public schools. The Urban Institute used data from the voucher program, which is officially known as the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship Program. Now, the researchers found that low-income Florida students who attended private schools using a voucher enrolled in and graduated from Florida colleges at a higher rate than their public school counterparts. Back with us once again, Tia Mitchell, State House Bureau Chief for the Florida Times Union and Jacksonville.com, and Jessica Bateman. She covers education for WLRN. So, Tia, let's begin by explaining, how do the vouchers work here in Florida?
Well, Florida has a couple of different voucher programs, and there's the two most well-known. One is for students who have special needs or differently abled. The other one is for students who come from low-income areas and that their neighborhood schools are considered, you know, low-performing or failing schools. And they're able to take these vouchers, which the state likes to call scholarships, and to use them to attend private schools.
So, Tia, it's Tom Hudson. Do the vouchers go to the students or and then to the schools, or go to the schools to then give scholarships to students?
It goes to the student, and the student is able to use this voucher to choose which school they want to attend. Of course, you have to find a school that is willing to accept the voucher. But yes, it's up to the students and parents, and the thinking is the money per student should follow that student. So instead of it following that student to his or her neighborhood school, it follows that student to the school of their choice.
And so, Jessica, what did this study find when it looked at post-traditional school, post-high school years for these voucher recipients, these scholarship recipients?
So the study found that students who participate in the program are 6 percentage points or 15% more likely to enroll in college than students of similar socioeconomic circumstances who did not participate. And that was mostly in community colleges. The study included only public colleges and universities in Florida. And the study said that kids who went to private high schools are more likely than their peers in public schools to go to private or out-of-state colleges. So it's possible the numbers could be even better if private colleges here or any schools in other states had been included. However, it didn't actually find that students were graduating college at higher rates. It found that there was little to no evidence that students who participated would be more likely to attain an associate's or a bachelor's degree. And the report said it might be too early to measure that for the cohort of students who were involved in the study, who entered the tax credit scholarship program between 2004 and 2010.
So the program's been around for more than a decade, though.
Since 2001. It's one of the oldest in the country, yeah. And it's the largest in the country.
And Melissa, you know, this it really gets to the heart of the long, drawn-out debate that we have in Florida every legislative session about how to pay for public schools and who gets paid for those schools, the use of vouchers. And, of course, that's been cracked wide open with this last legislative session and with charter schools.
Yeah, and to the point now where school boards are directly taking on the legislature and suing. Tia Mitchell, how does this new study, does it throw gas on the fire, in effect, when you look at this legal battle that we're seeing play out across the state with school boards actively now going to court and saying that the legislature is actively hostile to public education. I have another question for you too, Tia and Jessica. Teachers and traditional public school advocates are disputing this study. They're saying it's not an objective study, and I'm wondering what you both think about that too.
Well, I'll answer the first part of your question. I think, you know, this study is one of the many kind of, there's a study that can tell you just about anything depending on where you land in the debate. And so those who support tax credits and vouchers say this study shows they work, and for low-income students it provides better outcomes. Of course, there are those who are questioning the credibility of the study. I think it should be noted that the Urban Institute that authored the study is considered a liberal think tank. So in general, you would think that it was something that teachers' unions would normally side with. But again, because of the conclusions in the study, I also think the study should be looked at objectively. It did say higher outcomes, but if you look at the numbers themselves, it's not the margins are slimmer than perhaps the advocates of tax credit scholarships would want people to pay attention to. We're talking about a few percentage points in a lot of their data sets. And then the last thing I would say is there's just, with the Republican-controlled legislature, school choice is very important. Vouchers are helping students attend private schools. The debate over House Bill 7069 has to do with charter schools and funding for charter schools versus traditional public schools. And they all in this mix are, you know, what is considered the various school choice options in the school choice debate. And so a lot of it has to do with who's in power, who's in leadership. And right now it's Republicans who want more school choice.
But Jessica, it also gets to what we've seen flare up because of the charter school bill this past legislative session, which critics will say is continuing to build a dual public education scenario in the state of Florida. There's the traditional public schools, and then there's these other quasi-public schools, or in this case, private schools that receive public funding with vouchers that still have access to taxpayer money, but may not be held to the same kind of employment standards, teaching standards, testing standards that the traditional public schools are.
Right. So as both you and Tia pointed out, charter schools and vouchers are not the same thing. Charter schools are schools that are directly funded with public tax dollars, right, but they are operated by private organizations. And vouchers, even within Florida's vouchers, there are some important differences to note. The voucher program, the McKay Scholarship, there's also the Gardner Scholarship. Those are both, well, McKay was mentioned by Tia. Those are scenarios where money is going directly from the state's treasury to schools, whereas the tax credit scholarship is the state forfeiting the revenue that they otherwise could collect from corporations. So if you're a corporation and you have a certain amount of money to pay in taxes, you can decide to donate that money instead to a scholarship funding organization, which then gives the money to kids. That kind of distance is what has protected the tax credit scholarship from some of the legal battles that have come across, because it's not actually money going directly from the state to the schools. But there's a cap
but
on...
But it's still state money, though.
Right.
It's still taxpayer money.
Right. So it's money that has been forfeited by the state. The right. state decides not to collect that money. And there's been a cap on how much the state has been willing to forfeit in that revenue, or a cap on the tax credits each year. Under state law, it has gone up every year for the last several years. This year, it was $700 million. Next year, it'll be $874 million. So that's a big jump. And, of course, that's money that's not going into the general fund that otherwise could be used for public schools.
School vouchers, public education here on the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. You can join the conversation, 305-995-1800. Have you or someone in your family or neighborhood participated in this voucher scholarship program? What are your experiences with it? Lots of education news this week, Melissa. A separate study that was out about Florida public schools finds that they are resegregating. The Leroy Collins Institute of Florida State University found that Florida's public schools are becoming increasingly segregated here in the 21st century. A third of Hispanic students and a third of Black students in Florida, according to the research, attend what's called intensely segregated schools. This means schools that are at least 90% of the student body that is non-white. In fact, the research found that one out of every five schools was intensely segregated just a couple of school years ago, and low-income students represented more than 80% of the population in these so-called intensely segregated schools. So resegregation of Florida schools also here on the Florida Roundup. What's fueling this, Jessica?
Well, the study found a few different reasons. Obviously, it's multifaceted. But one thing is that there were court orders throughout the South in Florida as well that were mandating integration. And many of those lifted in the early 1990s and after. And so school districts no longer were required to implement some of the policies that would have led to more integrated schools. For example, busing students to different schools in different neighborhoods where they could be in a more diverse school. One great example.
Yeah.
I was going to say, if someone's interested in learning more about this, I would really recommend that they read the Tampa Bay Times Pulitzer Prize winning mm-hmm. series called Failure Factories, which looks at how the school board in Pinellas County made a series of decisions to abandon integration policies after their court order there yep. lifted. And it led to five South St. Petersburg elementary schools resegregating and becoming among the worst performing in the state.
Yeah. This is something that happened in Florida, didn't it, Jessica? And really all over the country, as people that are old enough to remember busing and how that played out in school districts nationwide. And then basically it stopped. And as busing came to an end all over the country, we saw districts slowly start to become resegregated. And so the effects of that are complex as we talk about that. This is a difficult subject to talk about because, as Tom pointed out, particularly low-income students are in intensely segregated schools. And so that's a cycle that perpetuates itself.
Yes, there
are a vicious cycle.
There are other state policies as well that have contributed to this. So there's mm-hmm. been a rapid growth in the charter school sector here in Florida. And the study found that charter schools were more likely to be segregated. And I believe that is true nationwide. So mm-hmm. if you have more of those, that could make the problem worse. And also, since former Governor Jeb Bush's his time as governor, the state education policies, and then also later nationally, the policies were focusing more on standardized testing and more on school grades. And so that shifted the focus away from school desegregation.
Yes.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup, a statewide edition. We're taking calls from all over the state. The number to join us, 305-995-1800. Robert is on the line from Miami. Hi, Robert. Good afternoon to you. You're on the air.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So my concern was that in the research study that says that children perform better in these private schools, how could that not be biased or anything? when the difference in private schools is so dynamic. You have private schools on the lower end of the totem pole, like your Lincoln Martins, that are, you know, anybody can be a teacher. You don't need any particular accreditations. And then you have the higher end, more premium private schools that people are paying tons of money, and the teachers have the best and most outstanding accreditations. So there's a huge discrepancy there. Does this study account for those massive discrepancies in private schools?
Robert, it's a little tough to hear you, but essentially asking about the different in quality of private schools with this voucher study, Jessica. Did it pick up, did it control for the difference of quality?
Well, the study was based on the students that they were looking at in the cohort. So it went to the schools that those students went to. It did note some differences, though, in the impact of the program on students, depending on which kind of schools they went to. For example, it said that students who went to Catholic and Christian schools had higher college-going rates than their peers who attended other types of private schools using the scholarships.
Jay in Jacksonville's on the line, and the number to join the Florida Roundup statewide edition is 305-995-1800. Jay in Jacksonville. Hey, Jay, how are you? Go ahead.
I'm doing well. Shout out to Melissa Ross, First Coast Connect All-Star.
Thank you so much.
Very welcome. I don't think we'll fix the segregation problem because people live where they want to live. But we can fix the problem with equity in school funding. We have, because most schools are funded by the millage rates and rich communities get rich schools and all the things that come with that extra funding, and poor communities continue to struggle. Until we fix that problem and make sure that every school, no matter what zip code it's in, has the resources to get great teachers, to have the extra programs, to get the counselors and all those things that are needed to support the students, you know, we aren't going to be able to make changes, and that over time will increase social mobility and will make sure the kids can get into the colleges they want to. But piecemealing it with charter schools or voucher systems is not going to solve the problem that we have in the state.
Jay, let me pick it up there. Interesting point. Let me put that to Tia Mitchell with the Florida Times Union in terms of any potential legislative response to this kind of study that finds that Florida schools are resegregating and oftentimes along socioeconomic lines.
Well, Jessica mentioned the Failure Factories report that resonated with House Speaker Richard Corcoran, and his result was to encourage more charter schools. So I think, again, that's an indication of where the current leadership in the legislature is going with this. They acknowledge the issues and the inequity, but his solution was not more funding for failing schools. And we've been talking about reports. There are reports out there saying that, yes, funding would change and does make a difference in the quality of schools, but that's not the solution he went with, and he's the guy who held all the power. His solution that he went with was more charter schools. I also want to make a quick point going back to the study about the voucher students doing better in college. And the other thing we have to be careful about is correlation is not causation. So the study conclusion said there's a correlation between being a voucher student and going to college at a higher rate than the non-voucher students in those low-income neighborhoods. But that doesn't mean the voucher caused it. For example, there's a self-selection that comes with taking a voucher or applying to a charter school, as opposed to your neighborhood school has to take you no matter what, even if you show up on the first day of school or the fifth day of school. And so we always know that if you're an active and engaged parent, you're going to sign up your student for the best opportunities. Perhaps another parent who doesn't have the time, the resources, or the knowledge won't take advantage of that voucher opportunity. And so that's what the comparison is. So it could be that the engaged parents, the more active parents, are also contributing to these higher college-going rates.
Do either of these studies, Jessica, add to the legislative debate over public school and funding in January with the next legislative session?
Well, I think certainly the study showing some positive outcomes for students who are recipients of the tax credit scholarship will come up in committee meetings. They'll come up on the floor as the legislature potentially pursues bills that could further expand it, whether to raise the cap more. Last year, they increased the scholarship amounts, which will help students who are in more expensive middle and high private schools afford the full tuition, because the scholarship doesn't necessarily pay the cost of the full tuition. And as for the segregation study, I'm not really sure. I haven't heard in my couple of years covering the legislature them talk about the issue of segregation.
We've got more on the Florida Roundup statewide edition to come. The state misses its own medical marijuana deadline this week. Your phone calls, 305-995.
Logic and love aren't exclusive to humans, says writer and naturalist Cy Montgomery.
The idea that animals don't think is insane. A much worse mistake is to think that they don't have thoughts and feelings.
Close Encounters of the Animal Kind. I'm Steve Curwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
Sunday afternoons at 4 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Science Friday, when the value of one Bitcoin jumped to nearly $5,000 this summer, just what does that mean? Why should I care? I'm Ira Flatto. It's the ABCs of Bitcoin, blockchain, and the hair-hurting world of cryptocurrency. Plus, want to go whale watching? No need for an exotic cruise? Why, whales are coming back to New York City. It's all on Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
When Ricardo Semler decided to reorganize his company, he started by asking,
why do we want everyone to be here at the same time? Why do we want to know how many hours a week people work?
So he decided he didn't need to know.
Please don't tell us all of this. We just want to make sure that you are self-directed.
Some called it anarchy. He called it radical self-organization. That story next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup statewide edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Give us a call. The number to join the show right now is 305-995-1800. Well, this week, the state of Florida missed its own deadline to hand out five new medical marijuana licenses. The head of the state's Office of Medical Marijuana Use blamed the delay on Hurricane Irma. That caused a delay in a lot of things, actually. They also, though, blamed it on a pending legal challenge to the state's expansion of medical marijuana licenses. Lawmakers passed a law in June designed to carry out a constitutional amendment that broadly legalized medical marijuana in Florida. The law called for an overall increase of 10 licenses around the state, some of which have already been awarded. Right now, we welcome to the show Ryan Bank, reporter for WJCT in Jacksonville, and Wesley Reynolds. He's president of Certera Florida, a medical marijuana operator. Let's begin with you, Wesley. Your company holds one of the licenses already issued by the state. So how's business? What are you able to legally do so far?
Well, thanks for having me on this afternoon, Melissa. It's great to talk to you and to talk about what Certera Wellness is doing with medical marijuana in Florida. Business is going really well for us. We are very much at the early stages of developing patient solutions in Florida, and we're excited about what we're doing. So I think we're looking for things to continue to improve.
So things are going well for your company, but Ryan Bank, what's the state's excuse for missing the deadline for this latest round of licenses for other people?
Well, it's a three-part answer. First and foremost, Hurricane Irma and the delays. Christian Bax from the Office of Compassionate Use under the Florida Department of Health sent a letter to the legislature basically saying, hey, Hurricane Irma basically diverted a lot of our resources to deal with, you know, the preparation and the recovery of the storm thereafter. So that was the main reason. Second reason, second major reason would be a challenge by a black farmer out of Panama City. His name is Columbus Smith. He was actually attached to a settled lawsuit over whether or not there was enough access to minority farmers for gaining these licenses. Of course, as you remember, in 2014, a law about non-euphoric marijuana was passed, and the office was created, the Office of Compassionate Use, and they went through a rulemaking process, and they set some pretty stringent requirements for nurseries that could apply for licensure. They had to be in business for a certain amount of time. They had to have sold a certain amount of plants. And so all of this is sort of carrying over to help with that, to help prevent another lawsuit along those lines. The legislature in June, during a special session, crafted a provision of this new law implementing the expanded use of medical marijuana that would outright say that a black farmer would have to get one of the licenses. However, again, the challenge that Columbus Smith is making is that the requirements for that licensure to be handed out to a black farmer are still too stringent. They have to be part of a certain black farmer association, and there are certain requirements that he said that basically, he argues in court or in the lawsuit are impossible but for a few farmers. Now, the very last reason that was given was sort of a more general reason, that the deadline of Tuesday to create five new or award five new licenses was just too stringent of a deadline.
Ryan, it's Tom Hudson. More licenses will mean a more competitive landscape for Wesley Reynolds and his medical marijuana company. But has this deadline been reset? Has it been postponed just to be reset, as the state talked about when it will be handing out these five additional licenses?
Well, backing up a little bit, Senator Rob Bradley, who is one of our legislators here in the North Florida area and one that has really been carrying this issue in Tallahassee, originally told us about 2 months ago that he expected a very smooth implementation of the law, because he said the foundation for it was already set after the issues that we had in 2014 and 2015. Now what he's saying is, I'd rather they do it be slow in crafting these rules than they mess up. So he's sort of setting what seems to be kind of an unofficial deadline of the legislative session start in January.
Let's talk about edibles, Wesley. Your company, Certera, wants the State Department of Health to come up with a rule so that you can begin processing and selling edible marijuana products. State law allows operators like you to sell edibles, which are banned in Florida, only to qualified patients as long as they aren't geared toward kids. So health officials have to determine the shapes, forms, and ingredients allowed and prohibited for edibles. That's the official language. And until that rule is in place, medical marijuana operators cannot process or sell edibles. You officially filed a petition just last week with the Department of Health. That starts a 30-day clock. They have 30 days to begin the rulemaking process or provide a written explanation for not doing so. Why hasn't the Florida Department of Health already set rules about edibles? And what's your position on selling edibles when it comes to medical marijuana?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're a fully integrated medical marijuana company, Melissa, and our obligation is to deliver the highest quality, most consistent medicine available in Florida. And Certera has been taking steps to make that a reality for some time. And our commitment is to the patient and the providing the patient with the best and most effective way for them to consume the medical marijuana prescription that they're given. And in a lot of cases, edibles could be and will be the most effective and most convenient way for a patient to consume their medicine. And our push to the Department of Health is simply to write the rules. This has been passed. It's been voted on. Everybody agrees that we will have edibles. But until those rules are provided, our hands are tied in terms of producing the edibles that patients need in the market.
Wesley, it's Tom Hudson. Did Certera supply suggested language for such a rule to Florida officials?
We have not supplied any specific language. We are encouraging, we'd be happy to participate in whatever is needed to get that language clear.
Right now, you're able to sell, what, oils? Is that right? Is that the only type of consumable for medical marijuana?
Essentially, we have oils and tinctures and sprays and vaporizer pens. We also can produce soft gels, and so any kind of...
Can you sell the soft gels, too, in addition to producing them?
Yes.
Okay. And what kind of opportunity does edibles present for Sutera specifically and more generally medical marijuana?
Well, when you say kind of opportunity, you mean how big is that?
Yeah.
I mean, our projections would say that the biggest need for patients today and what's most convenient for them is a combination of vaporizer pens and edibles. So as we see the medical market develop in Florida, I think we'll see quite a bit of edibles and also vaporizer pens continue to grow in the market.
Ryan, is this the state foot dragging on edibles and medical marijuana generally, or does it really take this long to set up regulations on a change this big?
Well, I guess it depends on who you ask. according to the department, for their part, they say that have already started looking at the rulemaking process. Now, there hasn't been anything released publicly as to what kind of language they're looking at, but they have said that they've already started the process, and it is something that they intend to do. So whether or not they meet that next deadline of the 30 days to come up with some type of rule remains to be seen. One thing to remember, though, edibles created in Florida will have to be look significantly different than they might in other states like Colorado or Washington. And that's because specifically it says that these edibles have to not look like candy.
Okay, and that's our own reporter Ryan Bank and Wesley Reynolds, president of Sutera Florida, a medical marijuana operator. Thanks, guys, for being with us.
Sure, thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Finally on the roundup today, Tom Petty. He died Monday night in Los Angeles, and while he lived on the West Coast for years, Petty's songs and sound were shaped by growing up in Gainesville. Over his 40-plus year career, Tom Petty sold more than 80 million records, and he became a uniquely American rock star. His music spans generations, from his authentic voice pushing back against the angst of punk rock to the dawn of music videos to dotting digital playlists. Warren Zanes wrote Petty, the biography.
There's space in the music, space in the lyrics, and those spaces are where we go in and kind of nest as listeners. And when we do, it's almost like the reciprocal effect is that those songs are nesting in us.
Petty would say the part of Gainesville he was from was the, quote, redneck, hillbilly part. He never lost his Florida roots as he created music with universal themes, echoing back to growing up and dreaming of what may be.
He's a songwriter who expresses longing. I often think of him as being in a camp generally with like Hank Williams, where I feel lots of longing, but it's also material that has this ease to it. It's a material that feels like it just came, you know. You don't see the work. I know both those songwriters worked, but yes, I think you rightly point to he's got the longing, and then he's got that dream of an elsewhere that sustains human beings. I mean, again, it's in those, look at American Girl. You know, couldn't help but thinking there's a little more to life somewhere else. Well, that's the dream of elsewhere that, you know, is the answer to longing.
Such a great song. Well, that's our program for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami.
Gina Jordan is our producer. Jason Zabka is our technical director.